I'm going to sue the shit out of TNA.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered a streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You fat! You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 465 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 16, 2016. I am the Solid Monster, and I saw this Love and Hip Hop headline this week in my news feed. I had to share this here with you guys. It says, Monice, and I don't know who she is, but apparently she's on the show, I assume. It says, Monice was outed by one of her castmates, some guy named Jason, no relation, who says that she was having an affair with Shaquille O'Neal while she was married. And he allegedly got her pregnant. Whoa. I would say this is the best storyline going right now, but that award would go to TNA after this week. What a shit show that's turned into. We'll get to that in a little bit here. Quick shout out to Sam Roberts and Jim Norton. They had Nancy Disgrace on their SiriusXM show to promote her new book. And they did not turn into Pillars of Salt. That's number one. Number two, they wasted no time in asking her questions about why she is such a vile, disgusting pig of a person. And she was exactly what you would expect her to be in this video. She had, no good answers for any of their questions. So after 10 minutes, what did she do? She got up and she walked out of the studio. That must have felt so gratifying for those two guys. A proud moment indeed. The video is up on YouTube. I encourage everybody listening to this right now to go watch it, especially with Halloween coming up, if you're into witches and ghouls and things of that nature. Nancy Grace has a bunch of books available on Audible, and I implore all of you to listen to absolutely none of them. Instead, you can use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster, to get yourself a 30-day trial of Audible and a free audiobook written by anybody other than Nancy Grace. For instance, The Death of WCW was a fine choice I would recommend. A lot of you have cashed in on your free trial and have grabbed The Death of WCW and have enjoyed it a great deal. That's brand new on Audible. And a lot of you guys have also signed up to get other books. Chris Jericho's book, Stone Cold's book is up there, Brock Lesnar. Death of WCW is just one of many wrestling books that you can cash in on, because when you sign up, if you go to our link, which will just take you to the main page, if you then go through the sign-up process, you can sample the service for 30 days. Cancel at any time if you're not happy, if it's not your thing, but you get to cash in one free audiobook that you get to keep no matter what, even if you cancel before your 30 days are up. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's a great way to support the podcast. Get yourself a free book. And on top of that, you know what? You might like it because they got a pretty good service there. Also, if you want to become a PayPal VIP, the most direct way to support the podcast, you can make a donation at any time. Voluntary donation over on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on this show. $30 or more will get you a shout-out and a quick plug for your own business or podcast, YouTube show, social media channel. I want to say thank you to our VIPs this week, including John Loose Cannon Lopez, the old veteran of the group. Beast Mode Brock Joseph, High Society Thurman Taylor IV, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, Alvin Chainsaw Siegerts, The Boss, Carlos Torrens, Last Man Standing, Sean Tobin, Fabulous, Alex Forbes, The Arsonist, Tim Tapp, The Mad Dog from Milford, Zachary Jones, The Black Buck, Matt Harrigan. I want to talk a little bit about Matt here, because I talked last week about something great that Matt is doing. He runs this thing called the Super Kick Foundation, and he's doing the Super Kick for the Holidays promotion. If you go to superkickfoundation.org, you can make a donation to the effort that he has put together. He's trying to raise $3,000 by December 1st. And essentially what he does with this, and he did this last year, I was able to contribute on behalf of the podcast, and we got him to his goal. He buys wrestling gear. He's a big Young Bucks fan, Young Bucks nut. So he buys not just Young Bucks stuff, but stuff from other indie wrestlers to support the wrestlers, and then turns around and donates that clothing to homeless people, because we're heading into the winter. Winter, especially here in New York, can be a very brutal time. And so it's basically taking wrestling shirts and wrestling gear and donating them to the homeless. And what he's also trying to do this year is buy toys for kids who, you know, need toys for Christmas. It's a really cool thing that he does. I encourage everybody to go on superkickfoundation.org and donate what you can. I've already donated on behalf of the podcast here. Proud to do so. What I was not expecting was a mystery gift that I received in the mail this week, I guess from my donation last year. He had the address, and I got, you know, a heads up that something was flying my way. I didn't know what it was. I got a box on Friday. I opened it. I had Fragile stickers all over it. I figured, okay, well, if it's a bomb, the least I could do is take it to the back of the office so that I spare everyone else's life. Take it to the back, open the box. What do I find? I find a Winged Eagle replica championship belt. An adult-size WWE Winged Eagle. Now, you guys know how I feel about the Winged Eagle. You know, I'm a belt mark. That belt is my favorite belt from when I was a kid. And I talk about it a lot, but I take this thing out of the box and I look at it and I'm just blown away. I just had no idea it was coming. Now imagine you're just sitting at work and all of a sudden a giant box comes. You open it up and there's a Winged Eagle belt sitting inside. This thing is heavy too. It's about 7 or 8 pounds. Thick plates, gold tip. I mean, he went all out with this thing. And I got a very nice note from Matt saying that this is, you know, a gift on behalf of your Sound Off fans. Really appreciate your work. Just really, really cool stuff. And I have to, obviously, I want to give him a shout out here publicly on the show because, you know, Matt's an awesome guy. I knew that from just this other work that he's been doing, and I'm happy to support him. But that was, honestly, that was one of the nicest things that anybody's ever done for me. And he didn't have to do that, and I just want to say thank you to him publicly here on the show because that was really, really, really cool of him to do that. And I've been like a kid the last couple days. I'm holding this thing. I'm like, I can't put this thing down. And now I got to find a place to hang it on the wall. I'm waiting for my belt hanger, the wall hanger, to come. So I'm like, I feel like I'm 10 years old again. So just a really cool thing that he did. Again, you didn't have to do that, but one of the nicest things that anybody's ever done for me. And I really, you know, when I say it sometimes, but I mean it, I got the best fans in the world. I really do. And I just want to say thank you to him and thank you to everybody else for the donations. It's very, very cool to have something like that happen, just completely unexpected. Hat tip to Deadpool, by the way, James Herrera, one of the other loyal listeners of the show. He tweeted me a photo from the options menu of WWE 2K17, which came out this week. Everybody's been making a big deal about 2K17. Coming out, while here I am just sitting here trying to master 2K16. And by the way, I uploaded a new Sound Off Gamer to our YouTube channel. Bret Hart against Seth Rollins inside Hell in a Cell. So if you can see if Bret survives the match without injury. But James sent me this image. Apparently in the new game you have the option of toggling camera shakes off and on. The dreaded Kevin Dunn camera shakes. As I said to him, I wish there was an option to disable distraction roll-ups and all mentions of Susan G. Komen. I would consider the game if they offered that. We are going to continue with our countdown here, my list of the 9 greatest interviews/promos in WWE history. We are coming down to the nitty-gritty here. Last week was Shawn Michaels' heel promo from Montreal before SummerSlam in 2005. We are down this week to number 3. In the countdown, we are in top 3 territory here. So that'll be later on in the podcast. No Mercy was last weekend, the second SmackDown-only pay-per-view. I did not do a Sound Off Extra on YouTube because I watched the second presidential debate. I wish I had watched No Mercy, but I did later in the week. And just a few quick thoughts, obviously very different opening the pay-per-view with your main event. They clearly did that. There was a lot of competition that night. I think there was a football game and they did it because of the debate. They wanted to grab people early. That was the most important match. That was the money match. They knew people were going to be tuning out, if they were tuning in at all. So they wanted to get it out of the way early, make sure everybody saw the most important match on the show. And I thought it was a really good match. I thought it was an excellent three-way with Cena, Ambrose, and Styles. Thankfully, you know, they did the right thing. AJ Styles retains, as I figured he would. They're not taking that championship off him yet. So if James Ellsworth is out there listening, I mean, good luck on Tuesday. But I think AJ's going to have a nice lengthy run with this championship. I thought that it was amusing and kind of sad that even on a show where they opened with the world championship match and they had this great long program, this great long storyline going for the first time in ages, some real focus on the Intercontinental title, that even with those two things, they still could not headline the show with an Intercontinental Championship match. They just, it was right there. They had the chance to do it, as good of a chance as they're probably ever going to have, and they still couldn't do it. They put fucking Bray Wyatt and Randy Orton on in a dud, in a stinker, in the main event. And why? What? Because the lights were going to go out? Because Luke Harper was going to make a surprise appearance? Luke Harper can't make a surprise appearance in the second-to-last match. It's in his contract. It has to be in the main event. I thought that was so stupid. Especially with the story they had and that stipulation built in that if Ziggler loses, he's... I mean, the moment that they announced earlier in the day that they were opening with the triple threat, I got tweet after tweet. Oh, well, I guess that means Dolph is done, Solomonster. This is it. This is his last night. They're going to end the show with him and... he's going to lose, and he's going to have the big goodbye. So they had people convinced that Dolph was losing. They had them. They had people convinced, and they still could not close the show with that match. I don't understand it, especially given the outcome. The hero won. The good guy won. Right? You think they, okay, go off the pay-per-view with a feel-good moment. Dolph wins the championship. He overcomes the odds. They still couldn't do it. I was just amazed. Becky Lynch missed the show. She had some sort of non-wrestling related illness or injury. She was in the hospital. Thankfully, they did not strip her of the title. I talked about this last week when the reports first came out that she was going to miss the show, but she was only going to be out for about 3 or 4 weeks. If she's only going to be out a month or less, you don't strip her of the championship, especially when she just won it. And they didn't do that. They've already announced that Alexa Bliss is going to get her championship match on the November 8th episode of SmackDown from Glasgow, Scotland. And Alexa, what they did with her on this show, instead of adding her to the Nikki Bella Carmella match and making it a three-way, they turned, they took Alexa and they put her in a match against Naomi, a match that really wasn't that good. And Naomi beat her. Here's a woman who's already been announced for a championship match in a few weeks. And she loses to Naomi, so that's weird. I don't get that booking, I don't understand that, but that's what they did. And so, anyway, November 8th, she'll get her championship match on SmackDown. That November 8th also happens to be election night here in the States. So, my TV will be glued elsewhere that night. Let's talk about TNA. My goodness. You know, I'm going to try to recap everything here, or sum it up as best as I can. Every week, though, it's something new with this company. Every single week, it's like playing whack-a-mole. I can't keep up. And it's all bad. It's not like mixed in, there's some good news and bad. You know, you hear that in movies. Oh, I got good news, I got bad news. Which do you want first? Fuck that, it's all bad. Which piece of bad news do you want first? We may as well start at the beginning here. PW Insider broke the story that Billy Corgan, the president of TNA Wrestling, filed a lawsuit this week against TNA, as well as Dixie Carter, her husband Serge, and their CFO, Dean Broadhead is this guy's name, filed a lawsuit in the Chancery Court of Nashville, Tennessee. Now, Dean Broadhead, that's the same Dean Broadhead, if that name sounds somewhat familiar, who posted on his Facebook page back in June that he had 12 hours. He talked about this harrowing experience over the weekend that he had, where I only had 12 hours to secure interim financing for the company. Does that sound familiar? And then he said, well, maybe it's time to retire. He was so stressed out by the whole ordeal that went down in those 12 hours, he contemplated retirement. I'm thinking right about now, he probably wishes he had retired. All documents are currently under seal, so you can bring up the case on the website for the Chancery Court, but I guess normally where you would find hyperlinks to different parts of the case, there are no hyperlinks because there's no details at this point that have been made available. It's under seal. Temporary restraining order was also issued for what we don't know, but the belief is that Corgan filed it to prevent Dixie from selling in the meantime to anybody, you know, selling the company out from under his nose, just doing anything, making any major moves until all of this is settled. A hearing has been set. There's a temporary injunction. I guess there's a hearing on Thursday at 11:30. Billy has requested a 6-person jury to decide the case. Yeah, I hear that word jury. I get flashbacks of the last 6 months. I don't want to hear that word. Although that what I was on was a grand jury. That's very different from that. I wouldn't get this kind of case. David Bixenspan posted a report on SEScoops.com that shows Dixie Carter personally owes money to Billy Corgan. And in fact, the lawsuit, I think, there was something that he had published on the site, and then like the day after is when he filed the suit. So she apparently owes money directly to Corgan. TNA owes money to Aralux. I'm sure you've heard that name before, that company. Aralux has a minority stake in TNA. They also owe money to Anthem Sports and Entertainment, one of the parent companies of the Fight Network, which also owns a minority stake in TNA. And the latest rumor, by the way, is that Dixie may have already sold part of the tape library to Anthem, I guess to make up for some of the money that she owes. I don't know if that's confirmed or not, but that supposedly is what has happened. At least part of the tape library may have already been sold to them. And they also owe money to a third company called MCC Acquisition Corporation, which is listed at the same address as Anthem Sports and the Fight Network. So they're all connected somehow. I don't want to say they're all the same company, but they're all, I guess, based out of the same office. And the last that last debt to MCC is dated September 30th, which was right before Bound for Bankruptcy and the last set of TV taping. So it appears we may now know who helped fund those shows at the last minute, and TNA owes them money as well. And the total debt owed to Aralux, Anthem, and MCC is said to be about $3.4 million. And we're not done yet. I'm just getting warmed up here. So Corgan's lawsuit was not the only lawsuit filed against TNA in the last few weeks. Came out that they were also sued back in late September by their former production company, Audience of One Productions. $223,000 plus interest is what they've been sued for breach of contract, among other things. This was to produce last year's Bound for Glory. And TNA, here we are over a year later now, still has yet to pay up. Now, also, remember, Eric Bischoff still has pending litigation against TNA. I don't recall exactly what the reasoning was behind the suit, but he sued TNA. That's been going on for a while, so that's still pending. And if the horse wasn't dead enough, why not beat it some more? We found out this week that the state of Tennessee issued a tax lien against TNA last month. So yes, the state of Tennessee now has the right to seize TNA property over thousands of dollars, I guess, in back taxes that have yet to be paid. I read somewhere it's something like $300,000 or $400,000. I don't know if it's that much. I don't know the exact amount, but I know it's in the many thousands of dollars in back taxes that apparently TNA owes, which means that if Dixie were to sell the company, either a good chunk of that money would go toward paying back the state, or whoever is dumb enough to actually buy the company at this point, they then would be liable for the money owed. Which begs the question, who would even get in bed with these people? Who would want to buy TNA at this point? This is quite the business that Dixie Carter's been running here. I wouldn't hire this woman to run a fucking lemonade stand. One thing that is very clear about all of this is that Dixie must really not like Billy Corgan. And as a result, it's killing this company. Of course, she's killing this company. She's holding it hostage. I mean, she's like one of these crazy mothers who thinks that her child is possessed by the devil. And drowns them in the lake in their backyard. Only in this case, the devil is Billy Corgan. She would just as soon see this company die than let him get control of it. Now, according to Meltzer, their next pay period, I guess, you know, the pay period for the talent in TNA was October 15th and October 30th. So the next pay period for all the talent was due to come up this weekend. Apparently some of the wrestlers are ready to declare themselves free agents this week if they don't get paid. He also claims that, you know, to go back to the rumor about WWE being involved in wanting the tape library, he mentioned that where they came into the picture, and WWE appears to be out of this now, and why the hell wouldn't they be? I mean, who the hell wants to get wrapped up in this mess? But Meltzer claims that it was John Gaborik, who used to work for WWE, who went to Kevin Dunn, his old boss, with the idea that they can make a deal, he could help get them the TNA tape library, and in return, he would get a job out of it. This fucking guy. Like rats jumping off the ship. But then wait, it gets even better. I'm not even done here. You should see this list of bullets that I have here. Apparently on Impact last week, some of the wrestlers were missing their entrance music. And the company had to scramble at the last minute to edit the theme music, some of the theme music, off the show. Apparently for Zema Ion and for Mike Bennett, I don't know if it was anybody else, at least those two guys, they had to edit the music off the show at the last minute, or else Pop TV might have pulled the show altogether. Impact might not have aired if they had not done that. Because there was some sort of rights issue, I guess, with the composer of the music. For all I know, maybe that guy's suing TNA also. Now, if it's true, and we don't know for sure, but if it's true that Dixie has already sold or is selling part or all of the tape library to this Anthem Sports Company to make up for whatever debt that may be owed to them, that tape library was the last remaining asset of any real value. So if they're unloading the tape library, and if you have wrestlers that are not getting paid, let's say, and they end up declaring themselves free agents for a breach of contract, then this company ain't worth shit. And if I'm Billy Corgan, I try to collect my money through the courts, and I run for the hills. I'd start my own wrestling company. I don't need this shit. I mean, who in their right mind would want to inherit this mess? Why would he want to? I can understand it if, for the name value of TNA, man, I want this brand. This is such a powerful brand. I want to buy the bones, and I want to just make it great again, as if it were ever great. That's what I want to do, because TNA is... No! TNA, the initials, the name, he's already said that he would change the name on day one. So if you're going to change the name, and let's say there's no tape library, you got wrestlers jumping ship, what are you buying? It doesn't make any sense to me. Now it looks like they're going to be filming a couple of episodes of Impact next month from Matt Hardy's compound in North Carolina. Well, I guess that's one creative way to get around having to pay for TV tapings. Let's go to Matt Hardy's house and tape TV. So I guess that could be the new zone of Impact for them. Apparently they're planning something called Tag Team Apocalypto, some kind of tag team tournament where they actually do legit invite teams from outside TNA to come and be part of this thing. It'll be a Falls Count Anywhere match, I guess, on the grounds of the compound, which I admit actually does sound kind of fun. Broken Matt has invited the Bucks of Youth. He's invited the Bulldogs, who are British, the Express, who rock and rolls, and the Days of the New to take part in this match. And Matt even tweeted that if Meek Man, as he calls him, allows the Days of the New to appear, he promises to make an appearance on Meek Man's show. Hey, if I'm Vince, I say no. All Vince has to do is wait about 2 months and he can get Matt on his show anyway. They're also planning the in-ring debut of Matt's son, King Maxwell, and a match, I put that in air quotes here, between Grado and Smokin' Joe Frazier. This is how it ends. This is how the story of TNA ends. With a 16-month-old making his in-ring debut and Grado wrestling a kangaroo. And yet, it feels like a fitting end, doesn't it? It really does. Paige was suspended for a second time, this time for 60 days. And she and her family took to social media. She was very unhappy when WWE announced this second suspension, she went on Twitter, said same shit, different day. And her family came to her, leapt to her defense, as most families would do. I don't blame the family. Her father went on social media. Her mother went on social media. Her brother went on social media. And they all defended her, and they said she had a legal prescription for a painkiller, and the company is not helping her, and they're not cooperating, and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I tweeted out, and I said, this is just ridiculous, the way that this girl is throwing her career away. Because I said before, you know, when this whole Paige Del Rio thing came out, I was the first person to defend them. I said, look, you know, people are trying to break them up, and they're saying this is terrible, or what do you do? Look, they're two consenting adults. Yes, he is quite a bit older than her, but it's not like he's, I mean, my God, it's not like he's 30 or 40 years older than her. Then I would say, okay, that's kind of sick. But, you know, otherwise, who cares? If they really love each other, or they think they do, then fine. And if this relationship is going to crash and burn, which it probably will, then let them do their thing, and it'll crash and burn. Let her make her own mistakes. But I didn't begrudge them for it. I don't see what the big deal, what the big uproar was. But the one thing I said was, she's only 24 years old, right? She's really young. If she can stay injury-free, and apparently she's got a pretty serious injury, if she's to be believed. Apparently the issue with her in WWE is that WWE doesn't think she needs surgery for the injury, and she's already gone to an outside doctor who says that he can do the next surgery and she'll be out 6 or 7 months. In fact, I think she said, might have been to TMZ, that she's supposed to have neck surgery this week, this Wednesday. I think she's going under the knife, and she'll be out for quite a while. So that's part of the issue between her and the company. They don't think she needs surgery, and she apparently has other ideas. Now, who am I to say, if this girl is in pain, you know, that she doesn't need surgery? Maybe, look, WWE doctors are not God. They're not the end-all, be-all. But I, you know, WWE, when it comes to, like, neck injuries and stuff, by all accounts, has always been pretty good. They have the best people in the world. They'll pay for the surgery. They'll send you. They'll get that fixed. They'll get that taken care of. I don't think of WWE as a company that's going to go to some quack doctor or is going to misdiagnose people, although maybe CM Punk would disagree, I guess. But the whole thing is just very weird to me. But again, the one thing I said from the very beginning was, you know, word of advice to Paige is, don't burn any bridges here. Be very careful with how you, I guess, deal publicly with the company. They don't like it if you go on social media and you bash them or you say negative things about them. Because she's not at the end of her career, hopefully. She's at the beginning of it. And even if things don't go well with her and Del Rio, if she gets fired or she leaves the company and she goes somewhere else, she's going to be back. It's inevitable that Paige is going to be back. And you don't want to burn those bridges. You don't want to make enemies out of people. Just be smart about it. Don't be stupid. And there she is, you know, on social media. She's, you know, saying her piece. And she's obviously very upset. And, you know, I don't know. When I mentioned that on Twitter and I said, God, you know, this is so ridiculous. She's throwing her career away. Everybody jumped down my throat. You don't know all the facts. You got to get your facts. Here's a link to her father's Facebook post. Like, okay, so what's your point? I already read that. I would expect her family to come to her defense. But I didn't buy it. Like, what they were saying, it didn't ring true to me. And then WWE goes to the New York Post, which is something they never do when it comes to the wellness policy and what people failed for. They never comment on it. And they're not saying exactly what she failed for other than to dispute what's been said by her and her family, which is that it was a, I guess, a legal prescription for painkillers. WWE, all they would say is that she failed for an illegal substance. And they just kind of let it hang out there. They left it up to the imagination what that means. What is an illegal substance? That can mean so many different things, right? It could be a painkiller that maybe she had that she wasn't prescribed by their doctor. Or it could, you know, you can conjure up images in your head of her being off in a crack house somewhere, you know, shouting, this is my crack house. I mean, there's so many different ways, you know, things that people think about when they hear that. But it was very telling that WWE would comment publicly on it and would go, actually, what she's saying isn't true. She failed for an illegal substance. And, you know, you see some pictures of her recently, and in some pictures she looks fine, and then in other pictures she looks just like something's going on there. And, you know, look, I just hope that whatever it is, if it really is just a neck issue, then let her get her neck fixed. If she's in pain, let her get her neck fixed. If it's something more sinister than that, I hope she gets whatever help she needs. She's 24 years old. You know what I mean? Like, come on, don't fuck up your life. Don't fuck up your career for a guy, or just because you're being stubborn or anything like that. So for her sake, I hope she's fine. Now Del Rio went on Twitter, if I can bring up this tweet here. This was last night. And again, WWE doesn't seem to think she needs surgery. She thinks otherwise. So Del Rio goes on Twitter and he posts what I guess is supposed to be a text message or an email from Paige's doctor. I guess that's what we're supposed to think this is. He says, interesting, and they say she's not hurt, ... And there's an image here that says, you have a disc herniation at C6, C7, pushing on the exit of C7 nerve root and causing all of your R side, I guess that means right side, upper extremity pain, and some pain of your neck. Also, you have a lot of wear and tear for your age. Now, I'm not one to say that why is this doctor texting diagnoses to people. I suppose that there are doctors who would text back and forth with their patients. Would they text something like this? I don't know. But I think that's kind of weird. Anybody could type that and, you know, say, hey, it's a text message I got from the doctor. I don't know what that's about. This is just a completely fucked up situation. It's not going to end well for her. And I hope that she knows what she's doing and gets whatever help that she needs, because I don't know. This whole thing is, and to go back to the stabbing story and the three or four different versions of that we've heard, that it was a car accident and people get out of the car and he got stabbed, and then it became, well, it was a homeless man who was drunk and belligerent, and then there was another story about how they, I think, were leaving a restaurant and some guy just attacked them and they pushed Paige to the ground and he was defending Paige. That whole thing is just really weird to me, you know, as far as having all the different versions of the story. I don't know what's going on, but it doesn't sound good. And hopefully she gets all of that worked out, because I just think it's really stupid long-term of her to handle things this way and burn bridges with people that inevitably she's going to end up working with again. It's just inevitable. So be smart about it. Be nice about it. Be the bigger person. Do what you have to do. And I don't know that she's trying to get herself fired on purpose. You know, people are just assuming, oh, she's trying to get fired. I don't know that that's true. I don't know that that's the case. If it is, one more strike and they'll terminate her. You get a third strike on the wellness policy, you get shit canned, and you can't come back for at least a year. And if you do come back eventually, you're not starting from scratch. If you come back, you still got two strikes against you. So to me, for somebody who's only 24 years old, why would you want to put yourself in that position where you now, for the rest of your career, even if you come back, have two strikes hanging over your head? That's just stupid. So, but I guess if you want out of your contract bad enough, you do funny things. It's just really sad. The whole thing is just sad. Goldberg is back. You know, it's a busy week when the return of Bill Goldberg is only the third story down here. You know what? I'll save the Goldberg talk for when I get to the Heyman promo in the Raw review. Let's just talk about Raw here. Raw was live from Oakland, California last Monday. Raw Instapoll, 51% of you voted thumbs up on the show, 49% voted thumbs down. So a virtual even split. I would agree. I thought it was a very middle of the road show. A pair of good matches, the mixed tag and the main event. And other than that, there wasn't much to get excited about. There really wasn't. I guess it didn't meet my threshold of three things, right? I need three good things on the show, one per hour. And I only got two. So I guess that would be a thumbs down for me. Sasha Banks came out for a promo a week after winning her second women's championship. Here's a fun drinking game for Sasha Banks promos. Take a shot every time she mentions the words little girl, Trish, or Lita. I love her. I love Sasha Banks. I don't know, you're turning on Sasha already. What fickle fan. I'm not turning on anybody. I like Sasha Banks, but my God, I feel like I hear this every week. The last thing I want to see is to see her turn into John Cena on promos. Where, you know, that famous John Cena promo that we've heard a gazillion times, where he comes out and you people bought your tickets and you can boo and cheer whoever you want, and the universe is great. Like, just shut up. I don't want to see her turn into a drone like that. So she challenged Charlotte to a Hell in a Cell match at the next pay-per-view. Charlotte came out. She was interrupted by Rusev, who said nobody cared about the women's revolution. And Charlotte then talked smack back to him, told him no one disrespects the queen. And Sasha then smacked the microphone out of his hands, and the two women ended up doing stereo drop kicks to knock Rusev out of the ring, putting the women over strong here. Rusev does a better job of putting the women over than Stephanie McMahon ever did. Rusev went to go after them, but Roman Reigns came out to make the save, and Rusev bailed. Now, there was a backstage segment that came after this with Roman and Sasha. They had a little bit of an interaction together backstage. And it was just my observation, watching this, that Roman came off looking awkward in their exchange. He can be a very awkward guy sometimes when it comes to these interactions on camera with people. Still, one of the most cringe-inducing moments I've ever seen with Roman Reigns is when he won the Royal Rumble, that infamous Royal Rumble, and The Rock raised his hand and everybody booed. They did an interview together backstage on WWE.com when that show was over. It's probably still up on their YouTube channel somewhere. And I don't remember who it was, if it was Renee Young or who it was that was interviewing them backstage, but there's The Rock, and The Rock's cutting a promo, and Roman's standing right next to him. And Roman, you talk about awkward. I mean, there's a moment, he has that smile that just looks so forced. And then it was almost like he did like the bust a cap motion, I guess is what you would call it. I don't know. And I'm just like, this guy is trying so hard to look cool and it's just not working. It just, look, it happens. He can be that way in certain situations, right? That's all I was saying. And as soon as I made that comment, the Reigns Brigade came out in full force. Why do you hate Roman Reigns so much? You're just a hater. I had one guy tell me to stop being a smark. A guy with a picture of Matt Hardy as his avatar called me a smark. That was the funniest thing I heard all week. I swear, you can't make this shit up. We had Lince Dorado and Sin Cara as a team in Cruiserweight action against Drew Gulak and Tony Nese. A short match. They've settled into 3-minute matches now here with the Cruiserweights. And for a 3-minute match, I thought this was good. Dorado landed a shooting star press on Gulak for the win. Mick Foley and Stephanie McMahon were out next. I don't know what Foley was wearing. It was like a checkered red suit. Probably something Christmas-oriented because he's a Christmas fanatic. I mean, he looked like a walking tablecloth, badly in need of a shave. William Regal tweeted this out. He said, I am the best-dressed GM in WWE. The other two could spend $1 million on clothes and still look like they are homeless, scruffy tramps. I love William Regal. Regal is awesome. And he's also right. Foley confirmed the Hell in a Cell match between Sasha and Charlotte, which will be the first ever women's Hell in a Cell match in history. You know, between that and the fact that the show's in Boston, right, it's in Sasha's backyard, just let them headline. I think they should let them headline the pay-per-view. I mean, let's be honest, okay? Be honest. None of the other two Hell in a Cell matches are really that big that you can, like, justify them. Well, we can't put the women in the main event. We have to put Roman and Rusev, or we have to put Rollins and Owens. It's such a monumental feud that they have going on at the moment. Not really. It's okay. It's not blowing me away or anything like that. There's really no reason you can't give the women a shot. It's a B-show pay-per-view. It's not like a Survivor Series or a SummerSlam or anything like that. They're in Boston. And frankly, I mean, Roman and Rusev have been feuding for 2 or 3 months now. So have Sasha and Charlotte. They have a feud every bit as big going on the last few months. So I don't see any reason why they shouldn't headline this pay-per-view. There was a time to do it. Now's a good time. So Foley also said that Seth Rollins and Kevin Owens would have their title match inside Hell in a Cell, which now makes 3 cell matches on one show. I don't like that. I don't like that at all. I think it's overkill. The last time they did 3 cell matches in one show, you'd have to go all the way back to 2009. That was the show that opened up with Undertaker against CM Punk for the world title. It's too much. If you think the Universal title is the top championship, and you have to have it inside the cell because it's the top title, then you know what? Roman Reigns and Rusev should not be in the cell. And if you think, well, Reigns and Rusev are the ones that have been feuding for the last 2.5 months, and so it makes sense to blow their feud off inside the cell, then fine. Owens and Rollins should have a different stipulation, then they shouldn't be in the cell. But to have three matches inside that cell, because, ooh, it's October. It's October. It's Hell in a Cell. Everything's Hell in a Cell. Let's have fucking the Shining Stars against Kaz and Enzo in Hell in a Cell. It's stupid. It's stupid. Jericho and Owens came out. Jericho put Foley and Stephanie both on the list. Stephanie was a babyface this week, for those keeping track. Standing up for Mick Foley, telling them that they need to show him the respect that he deserves. This after she herself disrespected him only a few weeks ago. She said the main event between Jericho and Rollins tonight would have big implications, because if Chris Jericho wins, he would get into the cell match and make it a three-way for the title at the pay-per-view. Cass and Enzo were scheduled to wrestle the reunited Bo Dallas and Mr. Not-So-Perfect, but Gallows and Anderson ran out from the crowd, laid out Big Cass with the Magic Killer. Dallas and Curtis Axel still wanted to wrestle. They weren't going anywhere, and so they demanded new opponents, and out came the team that creative forgot, Sami Zayn and Neville. Yes, a week after I asked where the hell Neville's been, and asked you guys to put his face on a milk carton for me, here he is, back on Raw. He also won with the Red Arrow. Reigns and Sasha against Charlotte and Rusev. Yes, after the opening segment where Rusev buried Charlotte and Charlotte dropkicked Rusev out of the ring, they were now tag team partners. And this was hilarious because it was so obvious what they were trying to do here, which was get Roman Reigns cheered by teaming him with Sasha Banks. I mean, for God's sakes, they have a video right now up on their YouTube channel with the title, Why Fans Love Roman Reigns and Sasha Banks. You gotta see the dislikes to likes ratio on this video. It's got like 6,500 likes and like 8,600 dislikes or something like that. And it's not because of Sasha Banks, I can tell you that. People booed the hell out of Roman when he was in the ring. They started a chant of, We Want Sasha. The finish, I will say, was awesome. Sasha had Charlotte locked in the bank statement. Roman then, while she's trying to tap out Charlotte, Roman gets in the ring. He sees Rusev coming in. And he comes in the ring and he flies. Reigns flew through the air. Even got some hang time for a second or two. Right into a spear. Spears the hell out of Rusev. Just as Charlotte taps out. That was a really cool sequence. It reminded me of the finish to that tag team match where Reigns and Bray Wyatt teamed up earlier this year. That was right before Bray got hurt again. Paul Heyman was on the show to deliver a response to one Bill Goldberg. They aired highlights of Goldberg's appearance on ESPN promoting the new 2K17 video game and talking about how if he were to ever step back in the ring, he feels that he would owe Brock Lesnar a rematch from their epic showdown at WrestleMania 20, which Goldberg won. And Heyman was really building Goldberg up like a big deal. He made him feel like a big deal, which they have to do if they want people to think that this match is a big deal. I saw some hate, actually more than some, hate online for the match. Look, I understand, I get it. Like, here's another guy from the Attitude Era, from the Monday Night War era, coming in and 50 years old almost, and he's headlining a pay-per-view. But you know what? Goldberg is still a really big deal to a lot of people. He may not be a big deal to you, but you might be in the minority on that. Because that DVD they did for him a few years ago, apparently, you know, for a guy who's been out of the spotlight for over a decade, or probably about a decade when that DVD came out, that DVD sold more than any other WWE DVD in a long time. That opened a lot of eyes in that company. And Goldberg is still a name. He's still a name. They don't have too many names left to exploit for big matches. Kurt Angle, honestly, is probably the only other one, and they'll get him next year. In fact, if they don't save him as a Rumble surprise for the Alamo Dome, like I pitched they should do last week, I fully expect him to be the 2K18 cover boy, you know, next year, and he'll end up back on TV after that, just like Goldberg did, right? They put him in the video game, now he's back on TV. They put Sting in the video game, then he came in and worked for them. They put Warrior in the video game, then he came back. So, Angle is probably the next one. I don't know who else it would be. And I'm okay with that. Because they don't have very many of these guys left. And if it's for a match or two, I don't see anything wrong with it. It's not like Goldberg's coming in for another run, right? Goldberg coming in, he's gonna be a part-timer, he's gonna win the title. He's coming in for one fucking match. And if it goes well, maybe they'll do a rematch. That's it. They'll probably put him in the Hall of Fame next year. I don't see this going anywhere beyond that. I mean, these people don't like each other. Just because they're working together, believe me, Goldberg doesn't like them, and they don't like Goldberg. And they probably don't want him around any more than he has to be. They'll get out of him what they can, out of a match or two, and that'll be it. I don't see anything wrong with it. Now, the key with Goldberg and Brock is they have to keep it short. They have to keep it short. Like, 2 minutes like the old Goldberg squashes in WCW, that's too short. Especially if it's a pay-per-view main event. But honestly, their match shouldn't go longer than 10 minutes. I would cap it at 10. I mean, between the promo video that they'll put together for this thing, the entrances, then you factor in a 10-minute match, you got half an hour right there. You just filled up half an hour. That's all you need. And Lesnar should win, obviously, because Lesnar's just been this unstoppable monster now for months and months and months. And 49-year-old Bill Goldberg, coming in probably only for one match, maybe two, should not be the one to slay the beast. He's not the guy. Plus, you know, Goldberg won the first match, so Brock needs his win back. And believe me, they can still get a hell of a lot more out of Brock Lesnar than they can Bill Goldberg. All the more reason for Brock to win. But if they have a short 10-minute, like, Smash Mouth kind of match, I got no problem with it at all. And to me, that's a big attraction for Survivor Series. They don't have very many attractions left. It should be saved for the Rumble. That's what I said last week when the rumor first came out that they were going to do this thing next month. And look, they haven't officially announced it for next month. It just looks like it's all systems go for Survivor Series. That's not confirmed. We'll probably find out tomorrow night for sure. But assuming that it happens at the Survivor Series, like I said last week, I would save it for the Rumble. I would build it up a little bit more. You got to get 65 or 70,000 people in the Alamo Dome. I know the Rumble is a big draw, but it's the Rumble itself ain't going to bring in 65,000 people. You need one or two big attractions. That's why I pitched AJ Styles and Shawn Michaels. If you could possibly coax Shawn out of retirement, throw a bunch of money at him. He's back in Texas. He's back in the Alamo Dome, the building where he won the championship 20 years ago. Plus, him and AJ's like a dream match. You do that, you do Goldberg and Brock and the Rumble. That's a hell of a lineup right there. That's what I would do. I would save it for that show. Now, I assume the reason that they're doing it now is because, you know, they have a video game to promote and blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. And look, they could still do the rubber match. You know, if Brock wins, they could still, if it goes well, if the people are as into Goldberg as they probably are hoping that they are, who's to say that Goldberg's not like, hey, that went pretty well, let's do another one. And they do one in January at the Alamo Dome. They could still do a match there. Heyman here in this promo said what keeps Brock Lesnar up at night is that Goldberg is 1-0 against him. And so, Goldberg, consider yourself hereby challenged to a fight. You're next, he said. Goldberg jumped on Twitter immediately after this segment. He announced that he will be appearing live on Raw tomorrow night for the first time since 2004 to respond to Paul Heyman. It will be very interesting to see what kind of reaction he gets in Denver. I believe Denver is where they are. I don't know what the crowds are usually like in Denver, so if we have any Denver people out there, let me know. All I know is that after 12 years away, Bret Hart made his big grand return to the company in Dayton, Ohio, and he did not get the type of reaction I was hoping for. And I'm being kind to Dayton, Ohio. He did not get the kind of reaction I was hoping for. I still say part of that was the fact that they changed his fucking theme music, but that's neither here nor there. But, here we are yet again, somebody else, 12 years away, just like Brett. This time it's Goldberg. Goldberg was not nearly the star in WWE that Brett was. I mean, Goldberg, you could say at Goldberg's peak, he was a much bigger star than Brett. Like, at his absolute maximum peak, he was a huge star. But in WWE, if we're talking about a WWE audience, even though everybody can go on the network now and watch all of Goldberg's stuff from WCW. I'm sure there's a lot of kids out there who only know him from watching stuff on the network and now the video game. But in WWE, Brett was a far bigger star than Goldberg ever was. And again, look at the kind of reaction he got 12 years away. So you can never be sure how the crowd is going to react. I'm hoping the people are hot for it. You know, hopefully it'll be a big moment. I think with all the visibility he's been getting because of the video game, it probably will be. I wish real life was like a video game so I could disable this third hour of Raw. One more note on the Goldberg stuff before we move on here. Supposedly, this is the other thing I wanted to talk about. So, supposedly, this is one of those rumor items that could easily be nonsense, but it's been going around that one of the reasons that they're doing the Lesnar-Goldberg match now, besides the fact that they want to promote this video game, is because at WrestleMania, where you would think a match like this, either Alamo Dome or the stadium in Orlando for Mania, right? Why not do this match on a big show like that? Why are they doing it possibly at Survivor Series? And the belief or the rumor is that the main reason is they already have an opponent in mind for Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania next year. And that opponent, supposedly, is Shane McMahon, which I guess would play off the end of what happened at SummerSlam. Now, I still think it's The Rock. My educated guess, I think it's The Rock. But this report says that it's Shane McMahon. Can you imagine? Can you imagine using Goldberg as a bridge to get to Shane McMahon? It's like, how ass backwards that would be. That'd be like facing Bowser as the first boss to get to one of the fucking Goombas. Did we not learn anything from that Undertaker match this year? 30 minutes that match went, by the way. Aside from his big suicide leap at the end from the top of the cage, that match was awful. And so now we're supposed to take Shane McMahon seriously as an opponent for Brock Lesnar? Is Brock going to sell for Shane's phantom punches the way Randy Orton did back in the day? Or the way The Undertaker had to in their match this year? It's such a ridiculous idea. I would say it almost has to be BS, but then again, that's what a lot of people said about the Undertaker match. That's why I'm mentioning this here. Because after this year, it could very well be a credible report. We have to take these things seriously. I'll tell you the Shane McMahon match I wanted to see, and they blew it. And it looked like they were slowly building to it before this brand split happened. Shane McMahon and Kevin Owens. I was enjoying the kind of the interplay and the insults between them back and forth. I would much rather see Shane and Kevin Owens in like a street fight at WrestleMania than Shane against Brock Lesnar. At least it'd be more of a fair fight, and it saves Brock for a bigger opponent. So I, for one, am hoping that this is just BS nonsense. But after this year, you know what? Anything's possible. I read these things, and I don't just cast them off as nonsense, because after Shane McMahon and The Undertaker in a Hell in a Cell match, if a year ago somebody would have said to you, hey, I'm going to predict who's The Undertaker's opponent going to be for WrestleMania 32. Oh, it's going to be Shane McMahon and it's going to be inside Hell in a Cell. You would think this guy was tripping on PCP or something. So again, you hear things like this and it's like, you know what? It could happen. And I hope it doesn't. They aired another vignette for Emelina. And I commented that, you know, Zack Ryder is one lucky SOB. And I have since been informed by you guys that apparently Zack Ryder was on Chris Jericho's podcast a while back and said that he and Emma are no longer together. Nor have they posted any photos together on social media recently, which they were doing nonstop when they were together. So apparently Zack traded Emma for Mojo, which hardly seems like a fair trade. TJ Perkins beat Aria Daivari with the knee bar. They gave these guys 5 minutes this time. Brian Kendrick was on commentary. The two of them will have a match for the Cruiserweight title at Hell in a Cell. And in the main event, Seth Rollins beat Chris Jericho to keep the match with Kevin Owens at Hell in a Cell as a singles match, which makes me very sad. I was hoping Jericho would be added to this thing. Rollins hit a springboard knee, but then fell right on top of Jericho in landing, which looks scary, but Jericho was okay. Bret Hart was sitting at home balling his fist up when that happened. Kevin Owens got involved, tried to help Jericho, but it didn't work, and Rollins won with a cradle on Jericho when he went for the walls. Rollins, after the match, went for a pedigree on Owens. Jericho saved him, Owens bailed, and instead Jericho ate a pedigree. So yet again, Owens bails and leaves Jericho to be pedigreed, so there is definitely trouble brewing between those two. Some quick thoughts on SmackDown. There was some big news broken on SmackDown. Shane McMahon and Daniel Bryan threw down the gauntlet to Monday Night Raw. And they announced that they have issued a challenge to Raw for a series of Survivor Series elimination matches. One of which is a 5-on-5 match pitting the 5 best singles wrestlers on each brand against those from the other brand. And they also issue challenges to Raw for a tag team elimination match, I guess with all the tag teams on each roster, and a women's elimination match with all of the women on each roster. So, minus the War Games part, they're going with the Raw versus SmackDown idea that I pitched. If they're true to their word, and they are going to go with the 5 best singles wrestlers on both brands, then they have to include the champions. I mean, you have to remember something here, that if you keep the champions out of this because you want them to defend their titles, you're not just excluding the champions, who in theory are your 2 best guys. You are also excluding whoever they're challenging as the number one contenders. So all of a sudden, a match with the 5 best singles wrestlers is not really a match with the 5 best singles wrestlers. So you have to have everybody in there. All hands on deck. So you can't really do a pair of championship matches on this show. You've got to include the champions in this thing. And so the way I look at this, if we assume that they are going to include the champions in these elimination matches, or in this match, the way I look at it, the Raw team would have to be Kevin Owens, Seth Rollins, Chris Jericho, Roman Reigns, and probably Rusev. And the SmackDown team. Now, I think that John Cena is missing Survivor Series, from what I understand. I think he's going to be busy filming the next season of, what's that show? American Grit. He's doing that. He's going to be gone for at least a couple months. So if we assume John Cena will not be part of this, then the SmackDown team would have to be AJ Styles, Dean Ambrose, Randy Orton, Bray Wyatt, and it should be Dolph Ziggler. But I could see them doing the Ziggler-Miz rematch on that show and maybe having like Luke Harper in there instead. Since Bray is in there, maybe have Luke Harper in there with him. I like it because with these lineups, if this is, let's say, what the lineup turns out to be, it's giving me a wild card match vibe from Survivor Series in 1995, where they paired off the heels and the baby faces, and they never really did another match like that again, or at least they never called it a wild card match. I like that wild card match. I go back and I watch it from time to time. So I like that. If they do Lesnar and Goldberg on top as the main event, you've got these 3 Survivor Series elimination matches. Maybe you throw in the Ziggler-Miz rematch, make it a ladder match maybe. And you throw in a cruiserweight match to maybe open the show. You've got yourself a full card right there. That's a full Survivor Series card. So I guess we'll see how the card takes shape in the next few weeks if I'm right or if I'm wrong. As for the key things on SmackDown this week, just to go through a few items here, I skipped some of the things on this show. I thought the Ziggler Spirit Squad handicap match was fine. It looks like they're giving the Spirit Squad another shot. I mean, they've been back now for a few weeks. I don't know if it's a permanent thing or not. Kenny was always regarded as the one that had the most potential, I think, out of everybody in that group. He was a young guy, had a lot of talent. I think he did well for himself. I guess it would have been an OVW. And then ran afoul of certain people behind the scenes. If you've heard me talk about people like JTG and Alex Riley on the show before, I think you can kind of get the drift of what I'm talking about. And so things didn't work out very well for Kenny. But he looks, you know, he looks to be in great shape. And I don't know, maybe this is his second chance. I also love Mauro Ranallo's line at the end, because Ziggler pinned him with a super kick, and as soon as he kicked him in the face and went for the pin, Mauro just goes, "Oh my god, he killed Kenny." And I laughed. I did laugh. And you know what? I can't be the only one who finds it amusing that Kenny and Mickey James are both back working for WWE at the same time. Like, they both come back around the same exact time. I mean, it's complete coincidence, but I'm just amused by that. AJ Styles gave a big victory speech coming off of No Mercy here on this show. It led to a match. AJ said, "I'm going to have a non-title match here with James Ellsworth." James Ellsworth's 15 minutes of fame is continuing here, which is cool. He seems like a really nice guy. I know he was on Wrestling Soup a while back, if you want to go back and check that out. So I'm happy for him. Because you never know how long something like this is going to last, right? James Ellsworth could turn out to be the next Sean Waltman, who is this underdog who just gets over and is around for months and months and months and gets kind of a nice run out of it. Or he could turn out to be, you know, like Gilbert. Gilbert really wasn't around for that long. You know, he came out, he did what he had to do, he even got a light heavyweight title run out of it, but he was gone pretty quick. I think that's probably the category that James Ellsworth falls into here. Although, I will say this. I pitched this idea on Twitter. I'm just an idea pitching machine here. I pitched an idea on Twitter that I think would be kind of cool if they can keep this thing with Ellsworth going. He doesn't have to be on TV every week or anything, but yeah, he could be the underdog who loses a lot and gets his ass kicked, and I would have him come out as number one. Well, one or two, I mean, it's the same thing. But come out as number one in the Royal Rumble match at the Alamo Dome. Because this guy, like, he's over. People like him. He's just a likable guy. He comes out, he gets decent applause. I think if he came out as number one in the Royal Rumble, and you kept him in there for a while, I mean, he gets bounced around a lot, and he'll get his ass kicked, and every time you think he's gone, he kind of sneaks back into the ring. I think people would dig it. I really do. I think people would be into it. I think they'd be behind him. They wouldn't expect him to win, but they'd be behind the guy. And you could even do a deal where, if you remember back in 02, Maven got that shock elimination on The Undertaker. He drop-kicked him out of the ring, and the place went nuts. That's one of the biggest pops I've ever heard on a WWE show. And it was this great moment. And then, you know, of course, Undertaker came back in and absolutely fucking destroyed this guy. He opened him up with a chair, bleeding all over the place. I mean, The Undertaker gave him his receipt for that. But that was a big moment that people still remember. You can do a Maven Undertaker type moment in the Royal Rumble next year with Ellsworth and with Braun Strowman. Because that's how this whole thing got started. They brought James Ellsworth in as an opponent. The very first week they brought in jobbers. Ellsworth was the guy who was in the ring. He got squashed by Braun Strowman. He's riding this wave, however long it's going to go for. I think it would be kind of interesting to do a deal where, you know, maybe he's number one and Braun Strowman's number two. But however you do it, he gets a shock elimination on Strowman in the Royal Rumble. I think people would go nuts for it. I really do. I think, yeah, it's just a small storyline for the Rumble. It doesn't factor into the finish or anything like that. I wouldn't have him there at the end. But I think it'd be, you know, instead of just having random schmuck number one and random schmuck number two come out in the Rumble match, at least there you got this story built into it, and I think that people would be into it. But Ellsworth, you know, he got a win here on this show over the WWE champion. Dean Ambrose was the guest referee. He, of course, fucked around with AJ. AJ had the match won a couple of times. He wouldn't count the pin. And then Ellsworth ended up getting the pin on AJ with an assist from Ambrose. And so it was this big, shocking defeat. The one very, very, very scary moment here from this match, I'm sure you've all seen it by now, was the nearly botched Styles clash. Now, there have been people before who have had their necks broken, not because of anything AJ Styles did, but because they took the move wrong. You're not supposed to tuck your head. If you tuck your head the way you land, you'll break your neck. You could die. It's a very dangerous move if you take it the wrong way. And most people know how to take it the correct way because AJ does this move every week and you don't see people breaking their necks every week. But you had that guy Lionheart over in the UK. You had Yoshitatsu. I know there was a close call in Ring of Honor with Roderick Strong. Thankfully, he was okay. You know, it happens. And I'm watching this, and I had already heard about what happened before I watched the show, because I watched SmackDown later in the week, so I knew it was coming, and I watched this closely. And this fucking guy, let me tell you something, AJ Styles literally saved his neck. He saved this guy's life, because at the last minute, he tucked. I guess it's just human instinct, and this guy is not, I mean, he's been wrestling apparently for like 14 years, so I can't say he's not an experienced guy, he should know better, but you know, maybe he's never taken the move before, I guess, but he tucked his head, and AJ, at the very last second, he botched his own move on purpose. He stuck his leg out to protect this guy on the landing, and he saved this fucking guy's life. And that right there tells you the kind of pro that AJ Styles is, because he's looking out for these guys. At the last second, he thinks enough on his feet to be able to do something like that. Go back and watch that in slow-mo. He saved this guy's life at the last second. That was very, very scary. But AJ was a total pro on that. And Ellsworth got the shock win, and so now he has been announced as AJ's opponent on SmackDown this week. He's getting a WWE Championship match. James Ellsworth will challenge AJ Styles on SmackDown this Tuesday for the WWE title. I think it's really cool. I think it's just a fun thing to do. They got time to kill now between now and Survivor Series. You got to do something. And Cena's not going to be around. Ambrose is. But you're not going to do Ambrose versus Styles every week. So what do? You have Ambrose fuck around with the guy. So he cost him a win on this show. I don't know how Ambrose may factor into the match this week. I guess we'll see what they do. Yeah, whatever. It's just a fun thing to do. I saw some people were upset about it. It's not a big deal. You know, so he pinned AJ Styles. So what? So what? I was waiting for people to start saying, well, they're burying AJ. Like, come on. Like, give me a break. I don't have a problem with any of this. And I have enough faith in the writers on SmackDown because SmackDown is, you know, look, it's not always the most exciting show, but I would say week to week, by far, it's not even a contest. SmackDown is a better show and a better book show than Raw. I just don't know how you can dispute that. You know, but I guess you can. Everybody has their own. Maybe your favorite wrestlers are on Raw and not SmackDown. You're entitled to your opinion, but I don't see how you can look at these two shows side by side. Forget the fact that SmackDown is shorter and say that Raw is such a much better show than SmackDown. It really isn't. So I have enough faith in the people that are writing SmackDown and booking the show that they know what they're doing here. It's kind of the same faith I have in the Lucha Underground, you know, writers. Even if you have a week where it's like, eh, okay, not the best show. You know what? It's never the start of a pattern. I've never watched two or three consecutive poor episodes of Lucha Underground. There are weeks where the show is kind of a dud or it's not overly exciting, and then the next week they come right back with something else. And so in me as a viewer, they've built up enough goodwill and trust over time where I have faith in those guys. Even if they have a bad week, I know they're going to bounce back the next week. And SmackDown is kind of building up that goodwill with me, I think, and a lot of other people as well. So you know what? Just enjoy it, because it could always be what it was before, which was just a throwaway second-rate edition of Raw with a couple of good wrestling matches. And I really don't think it's fair to call SmackDown that anymore. They've kind of carved their own identity out for it. And it's great for AJ, because AJ gets to carry a brand on his back, which he otherwise probably would not be doing. Actually, you know what? I shouldn't say that, because with Cena being out doing other things and Roman kind of getting de-pushed, if you want to say that, not really, but you know, he's doing the U.S. title thing. I think even without the brand split at this point, AJ Styles probably would have the top title. I don't think it would be Kevin Owens. I think it would be, you know, with Balor getting hurt and probably Rollins chasing. If anything, it might be Rollins and AJ. I think that'd be the top feud right now. So I think AJ would have ended up here no matter what. And I think he's been very entertaining as the cocky, arrogant heel, you know, carrying the SmackDown brand. I thoroughly enjoy all the work that AJ Styles does on SmackDown. He's one of my... Him and Chris Jericho. Chris Jericho on Raw, AJ Styles on SmackDown. I look at those two guys. Those are the two guys I really watch on both brands. And if you take either one of those guys away, I think both of those shows suffer a lot. Main event on this show was Bray Wyatt, Luke Harper beating Randy Orton and Kane. I didn't even want to watch this match. I looked at who was involved. I'm like, oh God. I watched it. The match was okay. I mean, it was what it was. They did a deal where Orton was crawling, going for the tag on Kane, and the lights go out, and when they come back on, Kane is off the apron. He's gone. And in his place is Luke Harper. He teleported to the other side of the ring, and he's extending his hand out to Orton, and Orton turns around into a botched Sister Abigail. Go back and watch it. It didn't look very good. And Bray Wyatt gets the pin. So a bad main event to add what I thought otherwise was a good show. They advertised Curt Hawkins. He was supposed to make his in-ring debut on this show. Hawkins himself said as much on the No Mercy pre-show. But I guess they went long, and so his segment got bumped. So they should fly all flags at half staff and declare a day of mourning, because Curt Hawkins did not get his debut on SmackDown.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
We have a sad tweet, which I'm doing here because it involves one of the new NXT guys, the one who got smashed by Samoa Joe last week. Dan Matha wins for sad tweet this week as Hurricane Matthew was bearing down on the East Coast. He tweeted, "As hashtag Hurricane Matthew begins destroying the Florida coast, I will begin destroying leg day." Dan Matha is a moron. I don't know why you would say something. I don't know why you would tweet something like that, knowing how sensitive the company can be. So yes, Dan Matha wins for sad, dumb tweet of the week. Hideo Itami, he's out with a serious neck injury. He is hurt yet again. He is not medically cleared, and he could be out for many, many months. He suffered the injury on a botched snap power slam attempt by Riddick Moss, one of the new kids they have down there. Same move that we've seen Randy Orton and Goldust do 1,000 times. It was a tag team match at a house show. This was 2 weeks ago. This didn't happen, you know, this past week. This happened, I think it was October 1st. It was an NXT house show in front of 300 people. Itami and Nakamura were a team against Riddick Moss and Tino Sabatelli, who ironically made their NXT debut together as a team on TV just this week. It's part of the Dusty Classic. But this match, again, like I said, happened 2 weeks ago. I saw the video. It was all over Twitter. And Itami comes off the ropes, and I don't know if it was a case where he jumped early, like he jumped when he shouldn't have. It's very easy to blame the rookie, but the blame may go both ways here. It's hard to tell. Itami basically got spiked right on his head, and everybody was scared at the moment. Apparently, though, he finished the match out. Everything, he seemed to be okay. Apparently, though, he was not. And this means he is out of the Dusty Rhodes Classic. He was supposed to team with Kota Ibushi. That would have been a pretty badass team. TJ Perkins now will take his place in the tournament. Itami posted a video on Twitter announcing that he was hurt, announcing that he was out of the tournament. He looked like his dog died. He looked so sad. But he vowed to be at NXT Osaka. They are coming to Osaka, Japan for the first time at the beginning of December. He has vowed no matter what, whether he wrestles or not, he will be there. And I just watched that and I was like, man, this poor bastard. First he gets hurt and has to miss the Beast in the East show in Japan, where they had that NXT Championship main event. And I'm convinced that he was supposed to beat Kevin Owens on that show for the NXT title. I am convinced their plan, because Itami was building momentum and getting a push, and they were building to the eventual GTS, which we had yet to see on TV at that point. And I am convinced that they were building to him going to Japan, going home, and winning the championship overseas. So he missed out on that. And the shoulder surgery either got botched or his shoulder wasn't healing properly. He had to have a second surgery. That's why he was out for like, what, 15 months or something? 18 months? It was crazy. And now he gets hurt again. And, you know, he may have to miss what I believe is the very first NXT show in Japan. It's like, this guy's cursed. And it sucks because whether it was his fault or not, that's two major injuries now for a guy who's 35 years old, got a lot of wear and tear, has had a lot of wars over the years, still has yet to make it to the main roster. Is it going to make Vince McMahon and those people gun-shy to bring this guy back? Even if he comes back in a few months and he's healthy again, do you call someone like Itami up to the main roster? Can you really rely on them to be a big player for you on Raw or SmackDown if they've had these two major injuries back-to-back? I don't know. You know, you build a reputation up like that, it's not good. Even if it's not your fault. It doesn't have to be your fault. You still got hurt. So it sucks. You know, but the thing that really pisses me off is fucking Hideo Itami shouldn't even be wrestling these guys in front of 300 fucking people in the first place. This guy shouldn't even be on shows like that. That's what pisses me off. NXT this week, we finally had the debut of Sanity, team of Alexander Wolfe and Sawyer Fulton, both of whom have wrestled as job guys on NXT in the past. They came to the ring with two other people wearing leather coats, and they were wearing bandanas that were covering up their faces like masks. They took on the team of Glorious 10, Bobby Roode and Ty Dillinger, in a first-round match in the Dusty Classic. Sanity beat on Dillinger for a while. And when Bobby Roode, who was still wearing his robe, by the way, tried to come inside, he saw these two. He came face to face with Wolf and with Fulton. And he had second thoughts. He thought better of it. He bailed on his partner. And so Glorious 10 lasted all of one match. They finished off Dillinger. They pinned him to advance in the tournament. And then after the match, there was a smaller masked member of their crew starts attacking and beating on Dillinger. And they have to pull this person off. And her bandana comes off, and we find out that it's a woman. It's Nikki Cross, they identified her as. And the other member then reveals himself to be none other than Eric Young, So we've got ourselves a brand new faction here on NXT. I saw the leather coats. I had visions of aces and eights. Horrible, horrible visions of aces and eights from back in the day in TNA. But you know what? New faction here. If it helps make a few new stars, which I assume is probably the point here, I think it'll be great to have something new like this on the show. They all seem a little bit nutty, all these people, right? EY's a nutty guy. So I think it'll be a good fit for him. Billy Kay pinned Liv Morgan after a boot to the face. Not much to it. TM61 beat Tino Sabatelli and Riddick Moss, who should totally adopt the neckbreaker as his new finisher. We got to see Tino's story on that first season of Breaking Ground on the network. He's a former NFL guy, football player coming over trying to get into the wrestling business. He's already a multimillionaire, this guy. He doesn't need the money. He wants to become a big star. He wants to really do this. He's got a $1 million body, I'll say that. The guy, he looks great. He looks the part. And NXT is the right place for him to be in. So, you know, a year or two from now, who knows? You know, Tino Sabatelli may turn out to be a big star. Now, this was only his first match on TV here. And he already had, in his very first match, he had the crowd chanting, we want Tino, no we don't. Dueling chance for this guy in his very first match. And he also took the losing fall to Thunder Valley. So TM61 advances. We got a match between Blake and Murphy. I haven't seen a match between former tag team partners this epic since Titus O'Neil and Darren Young. Thankfully, Samoa Joe came out to spare us and destroyed both of these guys. Although he did let this go on, I thought, for too long before coming out. He made us suffer a little bit before he came out to save us. And he comes out, he grabs the microphone, give me Nakamura or give me my title. Well, he got Nakamura. His very first appearance here in weeks on this show since Joe put him out with an injury. Nakamura ripped the neck brace off of his neck. He ran to the ring. The two of them brawled until Mata from Tough Enough and some other goons ran down to break him up. Joe broke away a few times. Nakamura broke away a few times. Then Joe left, but then he came back. This is a pretty wild brawl. They ended up in the ring. Nakamura laid him out with a Kinshasa to end the show. Hot brawl. Champ is back. Regal made it official afterwards that they are going to have a rematch at TakeOver in Toronto. And if you do not want any sort of NXT spoilers at all, this is the point where you ought to skip ahead 2 minutes, because I have two semi-spoilers. I call them semi-spoilers because is it really a spoiler if WWE already announced it on its Twitter? The two things I'm about to mention, WWE already spoiled it on their own Twitter. The first one is that Mr. ROH is now officially Mr. NXT. Roderick Strong made his debut at the tapings. He teamed up with Austin Aries in a first-round match in the Dusty Classic. And this one shocked the hell out of me. I did not see this one coming. Mickey James is back. She will challenge Asuka for the NXT Women's Championship at TakeOver in Toronto. They made the announcement. She wasn't there physically, but she appeared in a video. She's coming back, at least for one match. You know, with these one matches, you kind of just wait and see how it goes. And one match could lead to two matches could lead to three matches. You never know with these things. But she's coming back for at least one match. I guess they want to build Ember Moon up a little bit more. I still see Ember Moon as the one to take the title next. I think it's cool. And again, I talked about Goldberg earlier. You'll have people who say, why are they bringing back these old people? See, in NXT, and by the way, I wouldn't call Mickie James old. But in NXT, it's a little bit different because they've done this before. They've even taken people from the main roster. Look at Natty, right? They had Natty wrestling in NXT for a while, and she put over Charlotte like $1 million. That match they had at that TakeOver show where Charlotte beat her for the championship, that was one of the best matches in NXT history. So I think there's value in bringing these veterans back to work with the people on NXT. In this case, it's a little bit different because Asuka's not a rookie. Asuka's not, inexperienced. Asuka is probably every bit as good as Mickey James, if not better. So it's not like Mickey's coming in to work a match with fucking Liv Morgan or something. At least not yet. But I think as a match, I think it's a great attraction to have on that TakeOver show. And the story here, and here's why I think it works. I think it's cool because If the idea is that Asuka has just been steamrolling people left and right, she's undefeated, nobody can beat her, she's tapping people out now in like 20 seconds, no one can stop this woman. Even Mickie James comes in, the great Mickie James comes in and loses to her, as I expect her to. And then eventually you have a newer star like an Ember Moon, who is the one to finally hand Asuka her very first loss. I mean, if Mickie James comes in and beats Asuka, then that's fucking stupid. I don't see that happening. But fine with me if they bring her in and they have a competitive match, but she loses, and they keep building Asuka up as a monster to give her credibility, but then Ember Moon or whoever else, you know, is the one to finally get that big win. I think that's a great idea. And I assume that's what they're doing it for, you know, to give Asuka even more credibility. So I dig it. WrestleTalk TV has an exclusive offer for listeners of the Sound Off. Their Wrestle Plus premium service is home to a large archive of shoot interviews, including Kurt Angle, Rey Mysterio, Raven, and more, plus matches from WWE stars before they were famous, including AJ Styles, CM Punk, Samoa Joe, Cesaro, and others, wrestling documentaries, and a podcast series on wrestling history hosted by WCPW announcer Alex Shane and former PowerSlam editor Finn Martin. You can get access to all of that right now and get your first month free using the promo code RUMBLE92. This is special for listeners of the Sound Off. Use the promo code RUMBLE92, that's all caps, RUMBLE92. It will get you your first month free. You'll need to sign up with your PayPal account first and then input the discount code. Now be aware that after the first month, the service is $4.99 in British pounds, which works out to a little over $6 US. If you sample that first free month and you don't want to pay for the following month, you'll have to cancel payment through your PayPal account. Otherwise, it'll just roll over and bill you for the month after, so just be aware of that. But get yourself a free month of Wrestle Plus using promo code RUMBLE92. Visit WrestlePlus.com to sign up right now. Lucha Underground. Show this week opened with a shot of Dragon Ass Tekka Jr. in the dressing room getting ready for his match with Pentagon Dark. Chavo Guerrero attacks him from out of nowhere with a steel chair, pummels him into unconsciousness so that he can get the match with Pentagon. And as Chavo's walking out, he crosses paths with Rey Mysterio, and they kind of stare at each other, and Chavo keeps walking, and Rey sees Dragon Azteca laid out, and he goes over, and he cradles him in his arms, and he looks up to the sky and just screams, "Chavo!" like Khan from Star Trek II. It was so cheesy. Famous B teamed up with Dr. Wagner Jr. for the first time, wrestled in his suit, even, here in this match, against the team of Son of Havoc and Masquerita Sagrada. I don't know why, every time Masquerita just gives him the finger, he just flips off Famous B. I don't know why, I just laugh my ass off every single time. Wagner flattened Sagrada with the Wagner driver. He let Famous B get the pin. Pretty sure that's Famous B's very first win in the temple. Jack Evans and Sexy Star for the Gift of the Gods title. Now, either this was taped before Jack messed up his jaw, or by this point his jaw was no longer wired shut because he was talking trash. First time in many weeks that we've heard Jack Evans speak and talk trash, as he is known to do here on this show. He was very vocal. Sexy Star sent Evans face first into the post at one point early in the match. And Matt Stryker, the king of horrible one-liners, just said that Evans had a touch of post-traumatic stress disorder, which was so bad, it got Vampiro to laugh, and it even got a chuckle out of me, so I actually give him points for that one. It was better than ring post-itis, I can tell you that. PJ Black, pre-broken ankles, and Johnny Mundo both got involved in this match. PJ tried to distract the referee. Mundo hit a wicked spear on Sexy Star outside the ring, rolls her inside. Evans only got a two count out of it. Drago and Aerostar come down to chase off the heels and even the odds. Phoenix then comes out. He's distracting the referee, and that allows Sexy Star to grab a kendo stick. She crotches Jack Evans with it, and she beats him with a twisting, I think it was like a twisting fisherman suplex. I was going to say roll of the dice, but that's not what it was. Beats him with a suplex to win the match. So Sexy Star retains her title. And I must say, I'm not a fan of these intergender matches, but I thought that was probably the second best Sexy Star match that she's had in Lucha Underground. second only to the No Mas match that she had with Mariposa, which I loved. So some good wrestling in this match. Chavo is in Dario Cueto's office when Rey Mysterio walks in. He calls Chavo a piece of shit for what he did to Dragon Azteca. He wants Chavo in the main event. And the two of them, they break into this really overdramatic fight in Dario's office while Dario watches in approval. So then the fight ends, and now they're just standing there. And this gives Dario an idea. He says, look, Pentagon's already on his way to the ring. I can't cancel the main event and change the match. He's already out there. But I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll make the match a three-way. Pentagon, Rey, and Chavo. And that match just so happened to be next. And Pentagon pinned Rey Mysterio after a package pile driver for the win. A clean pin on Rey Mysterio is still a big deal because it just doesn't happen very often. So that's a big win for Pentagon. He went to break Rey's arm after the match, but Rey got out of it. He gave him a Rana, Hurricane Rana, from the mat. He was able to get him out of the ring. Rey then went for a dive, but before he could actually perform the dive, Chavo came from out of nowhere, gave him the pounce, knocked Rey halfway across the ring, knocked him halfway into next week. And then he grabbed a chair. He began bashing Rey's knee with the chair, and Rey's knees are made of Play-Doh at this point, and everybody knows it, so it's easy heat to have Chavo go after the knees. And they went off the air with Chavo Guerrero standing tall with a steel chair in hand. I am so over Chavo. It's just not even funny, but as far as post-match attacks go, I thought this one was fine. Obviously, it's building to a big match between the two of them, and so whatever. And that was it. That was a show. Not a whole lot going on this week. I thought it was good for what it was. Not enough Dario Cueto, though. I actually, when it comes to Lucha Underground, I prefer the shows that are very heavy on Dario. And I know he's the heel authority figure. I'm not a big fan of heel authority figures, but he's different. I put him in a different category. I would not say that about Raw. Oh, well, you know what we didn't get this week on Raw? We didn't have enough Stephanie McMahon. You will never in a million years hear me say those words. And if I do, I have to stop podcasting, okay? I will never, ever say that. Dario, though, he's different. I would watch an entire show dedicated to nothing but Dario Cueto. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. One of our listeners, Sean, is a lawyer. He's written me before with a lot of great insight on different issues. He offered this on the rumors that WWE was interested in buying the TNA tape library and what the holdup might have been. And again, it's kind of a moot point now in light of the news that's broken this week. He sent this in to me like over a week ago, but this is what he said, and I thought it was interesting. He said, WWE certainly wants to own TNA's tape library, but they've likely stepped back from pursuing the deal until the TNA clusterfuck clears itself up. What legitimized WWE's involvement in the deal a few weeks back was the potential for Corgan owning TNA. This is because Corgan has said he planned to change TNA's name to give the promotion a fresh start. WWE's offer to buy the tape library is contingent on a TNA name change and an exclusive proprietary interest in the library's IP. Why? Because if TNA continued under the TNA name and WWE put the TNA library on their network, WWE would be promoting a current competing product. WWE wants exclusive ownership of not only the footage itself, but also over the TNA trademarks and trade dress that exists within the footage. This would not be a problem if Corgan took control of the company and changed the name and branding marks. But so long as Dixie holds any proprietary interest, it appears the company will go forward under the TNA banner, and thus WWE will not pursue the tape library. So Sean sent that in again before the latest round of fuckery with that company, so TNA going forward at all is looking less and less likely. Jessica from Houston, what are your thoughts on the Michael Hayes and Bret Hart situation? Do you think this is just another case of bitter Bret, or does he have some merit to say the Freebirds were not worthy of their Hall of Fame induction? Bret has since apologized, since Jessica sent this question in. He apologized for the comments he made about the Freebirds, how they don't belong in the Hall of Fame. They never drew any money. They're not WWE guys. They were a bunch of pill poppers. I mean, he went off on them. And he has since apologized for those comments and also apologized for all the comments he's ever made about Seth Rollins. Bret was clearly gotten to by someone. But I thought it was a classy apology, even if it was something that he was kind of provoked into doing, which I have a feeling he was. It just sort of came out of nowhere. So maybe he just said, you know, I feel really bad. I'm just going to have a blanket apology. Or again, like I said, he was gotten to. But either way, I thought it was a very classy thing that he said on his Facebook page. So as far as I'm concerned, it's a dead issue. And it's a good thing it is, because I had a lot to say when I got your question. I was going to include it here in this mailbag, and I had a lot I wanted to say about what Brett said and how he is entitled to his opinion, and I love how open and honest he is, but it was really stupid. It was really stupid what he said, especially because on his own podcast, I had gone back to check, because I had never heard him make any comments about the Freebirds at all, or Michael Hayes. I'm like, where is this coming from? And so I checked, and on his very own podcast earlier this year, this is before he stopped doing them, he said that he had no objection to the Freebirds going into the Hall of Fame or being in the Hall of Fame. His objection was to the other guys that are not in there, like Owen, like Davey Boy, like Demolition, like Rick Rude. And I agree with him on that. All of those guys should be part of any WWE Hall of Fame. You know, those guys all deserve to be recognized in some form or fashion. Now, the Owen thing, we know why he's not, and it has everything to do with Martha and them not wanting to get into a public pissing contest with the woman who lost her husband on one of their own shows. I get it. I still think Owen is going in at some point. I just think Brett and other people need to be patient, but at some point I do think it's going to happen. Got a question here from Will. I'm throwing it out there to all of you guys. I can't help him with this. Maybe you can. It's about the WWE History of the Hardcore Championship 24/7 DVD. It says, on the main menu of that DVD, I really love the song that's playing, and I have no idea how to find out what band sings it. I don't know if you have that DVD. Do you know where I could go online to find the answer or who I could ask? I could not find it in a Google search. So if you are the owner of WWE's History of the Hardcore Championship DVD, Will is looking for the name of the song that's playing on the main menu. I can't help him. Maybe somebody else can. If you can, either post it in the Facebook group or email it to me and I'll pass it along to Will. Orlando from Philadelphia. Can you explain to me what happened with Mr. Kennedy at WrestleMania 23? He got the Money in the Bank briefcase, but for some weird reason, Edge ended up beating him for it. And for a long time, though, Kennedy was built up as a legitimate star. He was beating former world champions. Can you explain to me what caused the downfall of Mr. Kennedy? Well, there's a few things that caused the downfall of Mr. Kennedy. I mean, what happened with the Money in the Bank briefcase was he got hurt. And I think he thought he either had a torn bicep or a torn tricep. He might have been told that. They thought he was going to be out for a while. And so they felt they had to get the briefcase off of him. Because they, if you remember, they started a countdown. They were doing a gimmick where he was planning on cashing in at WrestleMania the following year. And he had started a countdown clock. I don't know if they would have stuck with it or not. Maybe it was a swerve and he would have cashed in, you know, at a non-WrestleMania show. But they thought he was hurt. He thought he was hurt. And they had to get it off of him. So they rushed the briefcase off of him, I think within a few weeks. And then, unfortunately for him, they found out it wasn't, I think, a tear. It was like a deep bruise. And so he wasn't going to be out as long as he originally thought. But by that point, they had already taken the briefcase off of him. So it was just a case of bad luck for him. And then the belief, I think, was that he was going to, in the storyline with Vince McMahon's son, he was going to be revealed as Vince's illegitimate son and feud with Triple H. I mean, that's a big spot to be in. And I think it was around that time he flunked a drug test. Either he flunked a drug test or it might not have been a failed drug test. That might have been the Signature Pharmacy scandal. I think that's what it was. I'm just going off the top of my head here. I think it was around the time that those, it was like 11 names showed up on this list for Signature Pharmacy, which was raided. It was a whole big scandal, and I think his name was on there. So it was one of those, it was something drug-related, and so he fucked up his chances, and they changed it to Hornswoggle. It wasn't meant to be a joke. It was supposed to get the guy over as a major star. And think about that position. I mean, to be Vince McMahon's illegitimate son and possibly feud with Triple H, that could have been a WrestleMania match. I think that might have been the plan. That was a big, big spot for him. Even bigger than probably the Money in the Bank thing. Although, you know, cashing in at WrestleMania, winning the championship, if that's how it worked would have been a big deal. But just time after time, whether it was bad luck or stupid decisions or stupid things that he said, and then he came back, remember, from another injury, and he suplexed Randy Orton, and Randy Orton freaked out backstage because he suplexed him, and he had the clavicle injuries, and he thought that Kennedy was unsafe and reckless, and just a bunch of guys spoke up, including John Cena, and I think Shawn Michaels and others, and that was the end of Mr. Kennedy, and he hasn't been back since, and he may never be back. So it was just a string of bad luck for him, but as far as Money in the Bank was, he had an injury they thought was a tear. It turned out not to be a tear, and by that point, it was too late. Andy from Manchester, England. At the end of the 1997 Royal Rumble match, the last four competitors included the fake Diesel, played by Glenn Jacobs. Yet, he was not featured the following month in the Final Four main event at In Your House. Was this due to some kind of a botch in the Rumble match itself? No. So what happened there was Steve Austin was eliminated from the Royal Rumble by Bret Hart. The referees didn't see it because there was a big brawl outside the ring between Mankind and Terry Funk. So all the refs were trying to break them up on the other side of the ring. And so Austin snuck back into the ring. He dumped The Undertaker out. He dumped Vader out. And then he dumped out Bret Hart. I'm pretty sure Bret dumped out fake Diesel and not Austin. So Bret was legal. Him eliminating Diesel was a perfectly legal elimination. What wasn't legal was Austin eliminating the other three guys, because technically, they didn't realize this until after, but technically Austin had already been eliminated. And so it basically invalidated him eliminating Undertaker, Vader, and Bret. And so Gorilla Monsoon, after the fact, he said that all the people that Austin eliminated while he was illegally in the match would be in that four-way match with Austin, who he did win, technically. He did get the Rumble win, so that's how the Final Four came together. And that was the logic behind it. It actually made sense. Vineet from Mumbai, India. His question concerns the Four Horsemen. Weren't the point of heel stables that young upstart heels and mid-carders get rubbed from the main eventer, as with Evolution and DX? Why did other members of the Four Horsemen, like Arn, Ole, and Tully, never get a world title run, or main event rubs? Well, I would argue that they, just by being in the Horsemen, they were getting a main event rub. Anyway, he says, how is it also that wrestlers like Rhodes and Flair, despite being main eventers, also got booking roles? Is that not a conflict of interest? I've seen this often back in the day with people like Vern Gagne, etc., where the head booker and the title holder are one and the same. Does this not affect locker room morale? I always see old school marks love Flair and Rhodes, but never criticize them for this, while the same people hold it against Triple H. Well, you know what? That's a fair point. You could say Triple H wasn't doing anything that those guys didn't do. You can argue that some were more selfish than others, but no, I mean, you know, when you have that kind of power, you look out for number one. That's what you do. You look out for yourself. And so, yes, that's a fair point to make about Triple H. And I'm sure that plenty of guys were bothered by it, you know, back in the day, especially Vern in the AWA. I mean, they didn't talk about this so much when Vern went into the Hall of Fame all those years ago, you know, in his video, but I mean, he practically super glued himself to that top spot, even into his 50s. He was in his mid-50s. I mean, for God's sake, the guy retired while he was still the champion of his own promotion, instead of dropping it to somebody else. So yeah, I'm sure lots of guys who worked for him were frustrated. Hogan bailed on him. Lots of guys bailed on him. I mean, that's where all those WWF guys came from in the mid-80s. What do you think it was? I mean, it wasn't just the money. I mean, if they were perfectly happy and making decent money for Vern in the AWA, a lot of those guys wouldn't have bailed. But between the money and the fact that fucking Vern was the number one guy, I'm sure they looked at that and said, shit, you know? Now, Vern, I think, retired in 81? 82? It was sometime in the early 80s. I think it was before Vince's raid of all of his talent officially began. So I don't know that Vern kind of booking himself to be the champion was such an issue at that point. I think Bockwinkel was the champion by that point. But I'm sure just Vern's way of doing things, there was quite a bit of frustration. And actually, you'll find plenty of guys that have said some not-so-nice things about Vern Gagne. Even Bobby Heenan, I think, who worked quite a bit in the AWA. I think at one point he referred to the AWA as all the world's assholes. So yeah, I'd say there were plenty of frustrated people there. Now you said, isn't the point of heel stables that it gets young guys over or gives somebody new the rub from working with them? First of all, that's not always the point of setting up a heel faction. I talked about sanity earlier here on this podcast, right, in NXT with Eric Young. I'm sure part of the point there is not just to give Eric Young something to do, but they've got Alexander Wolf and they've got Sawyer Fulton. And I'm sure part of the plan or the hope is that by putting these guys together, and Eric Young's a veteran guy, he can help, you know, these guys become something on NXT. Right now, they're nothing. And hopefully coming out of that, maybe they'll make some stars out of it. In cases like that, yes. Evolution is a prime example of that. Triple H and Ric Flair. I mean, those two guys, Orton and Batista, were handpicked. Handpicked by Triple H. And even when they got hurt. Remember that match, that house show match where like everybody got hurt? It was Orton and Batista against the Dudley Boys. And like Orton broke his foot and Batista got hurt. And I think Bubba got hurt. Everybody got hurt. And I think Orton and Batista were going to be out for a while. And maybe it was Orton who told the story of Triple H telling him, look, your spot's going to be safe when you're ready to come back. Don't worry about it. They had their sights locked on those two guys. And the idea was to make them stars, to get them over and make them big stars. And it worked. It worked. Batista got more over than Orton did at first. And then Orton went on to become one of the biggest stars that the company's had in the last, you know, 15 years. So Evolution is a prime example of what you're talking about, but not every single heel stable is meant to do that. I mean, The Rock got over big time in The Nation. They got him over, you know, like $1 million, that heel turn, and the dissension then with him and Farouk. That was a big part of The Rock getting over as a big heel back then. But I don't think they put fucking Los Boricuas together to get anybody over as a big single star. I don't think, the Truth Commission came together with the idea that, you know, one of those guys was going to go on to become a massive star. And the Horsemen, I think, more came together, if anything, to help those NWA babyfaces get over. Dusty Rhodes, right? Fighting against the Horsemen, Magnum TA, Sting. That's why they had so many strong babyfaces down there. They didn't even have a name for the Horsemen. Arn Anderson just randomly mentioned the Horsemen name in a promo and it stuck and they ran with it. So I don't know that the point from the beginning was to make Arn Anderson a world champion or make Tully Blanchard a world champion. I mean, part of the problem also may have been that, you know, they weren't going to turn those guys to feud with Ric Flair. Arn Anderson was not going to go babyface to feud with Flair for the championship. Why would Arn Anderson go babyface and feud with Flair for the title when they had Sting, and they had Dusty Rhodes, and they had Lex Luger, and they had Ricky Steamboat, and they had Nikita Koloff? Like, why? You don't have to do that. They didn't have to. They had a lot of strong baby faces already. Those guys were better off being heels. Alvin from up north has a non-wrestling buy or sell. We'll do a non-wrestling one this week. Terminator 2, Judgment Day, or Batman the Dark Knight? I hate to choose. I picked this one because it is kind of a hard one, but I hate to choose. To me, they're two of the greatest sequels ever made. I guess you'd probably put The Godfather Part 2 at the top, but The Dark Knight, I think The Dark Knight is incredible. T2 is also a pretty damn great movie. The special effects in T2, I think, would hold up even today. I have to buy on The Dark Knight. I'm going to buy on The Dark Knight. I'm going to sell on T2. I just think Heath Ledger's performance in The Dark Knight, that interrogation scene with Batman when Batman realizes how powerless he is against the Joker, their use of music in that movie, just everything about it. The one criticism I have is I wish they would have done more with Two-Face and his story, but you know, then I think about what Raimi did with Venom in that third Spider-Man movie, and you talk about disappointment, and it's like, okay, you know. What they did with Two-Face in The Dark Knight doesn't seem nearly as bad as what they did with Venom in that Spider-Man movie. But like I said, even the music, and I could say the music for both movies, you know, that score though for The Dark Knight, you know, that kind of brooding music, it just matched so perfectly with everything on the screen, and it was just I just thought it was an epic movie. So Dark Knight gets my vote, but you can't go wrong with either one. If you've never seen Terminator 2, there's like a younger people listening to this who never saw that. And if you've seen like the newer Terminator, like they had, what was that one, Terminator Genesis or something? Fuck that. Go back and watch T2. You want to see a real fun movie, go back and watch that.
Because I know you used to be this brash, rebellious superstar. You know, me and you, we're a lot alike in that regard. I'll say whatever I want.
I got news for you. You and I are not alike. Certainly, we've got similarities. We don't smoke, we don't drink, we don't do drugs, but you know
anymore.
Something? Fair enough.
That was the opening promo from the June 27th, 2011 episode of Monday Night Raw from Las Vegas. Shawn Michaels was there to promote his new hunting show and was interrupted by CM Punk and the new Nexus. And it would turn out to be a very memorable night for CM Punk as we continue here with our countdown of the top 9 WWE interviews and promos of all time as ranked by me. So this is my own list, ranked in order from the least best to the best best, I guess you would say. We are now in top 3 territory on this list, and that promo, or that part of that promo that I just played, that's not number 3 on the list. I just wanted an excuse to use that line there at the end by CM Punk, where Shawn says, "We don't do drugs," and Punk just goes, "Anymore." I just thought that was great. But this is exactly what you think it is. Number 3 in the countdown is the famous pipe bomb that Punk dropped at the end of the show. And I'm as tired as you are probably of hearing that word, that word pipe bomb. It's been so bastardized since then. But that is what this is. Punk was frustrated. They had disbanded the Straight Edge Society many months earlier that he was the leader of over on SmackDown. And he lost to Randy Orton at WrestleMania. He floundered after that for months, doing much of nothing. And then finally, he got a couple of big wins on TV. He got a win over John Cena, who was the champion. He earned himself a championship match, and it just so happened to fall the same night that his contract was set to expire. So I'm sure they were trying to sign him to a new deal, probably for months, and he was saying no, 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 no. And now his contract is coming due, and all of a sudden they give him a big win over John Cena. Now he's got a championship match on pay-per-view, and it happens to be in Chicago, his hometown. Everything was coming together for him just as they wanted him to sign a new deal. And it's funny how that works. Even Ryback said the same thing, right? How convenient that is. Ryback didn't know why they gave him the Intercontinental title. And then when they started badgering him about signing a new contract, he's like, "Ah, I see. I see." But Punk was convinced he was leaving. Like, legit, I'm out of here. He had enough. He was genuinely pissed off that The Rock had already been announced for next year's WrestleMania main event. Meanwhile, he had never been in a WrestleMania main event, but he'd been busting his ass for years in that company. And so they acknowledged on TV, they worked it into the storyline, that his contract was set to expire on July 17th at midnight. And they teased that he might win the WWE Championship and leave with it. And the main event on this show here, this Monday Night Raw episode, was a tables match between John Cena and R-Truth. Punk had already wrestled a match with Kane earlier in the show. And he knew he had to come out. He was due to come out and interfere in the Cena match, but he needed a new shirt to wear. And so as he tells the story, he was looking around in his bag, and he found a Stone Cold Steve Austin shirt in his bag, which got a lot of people talking because Punk made it very well known for years. He made it very well known that was the match that he wanted. He was constantly trying to talk Steve Austin out of retirement. He wanted one match against him at WrestleMania. And Punk even tweeted, a tweet that a lot of you might remember. He sent a tweet to Austin that just said, "29, son." And Austin teased the shit out of everybody. He wrote back, "Just worry about 28. If the stars all line up, I always have a big can of whoop-ass ready to take to New York City." That's just not fair. That's just not fair. He was playing along with it. I mean, hey, Austin's smart. He never closed any doors. Only in like recent years has he finally said, "I'm done. I'm not coming back." And I think he's kind of at peace with the whole thing. But for years, he would never say no. He would always say, "Well, if I did come back, I think I have a good 2-year run in me. And, you know, this is who I'd want to face. And I would do just fine." He never closed the door. Which is smart. Never, ever close the door. But unfortunately for all of us who wanted to see that match, he was just stringing us along. Obviously, the match never happened. But there he was, out there in a Stone Cold shirt. He just cost John Cena the match. R-Truth speared Cena through a table that was stacked up in the corner. I remember John Cena selling that table bump for a good 10 minutes. That table must have been made of concrete for as long as he was laying there after he went through it. And Punk grabbed the microphone. He walked all the way up to the stage. He sat down Indian style. And what followed is one of the most memorable promos, and I think one of the best in company history. And I see a lot of people nowadays love to hate on this thing. It's so overrated. That promo was so overrated. I think people are just tired of hearing about it. I don't doubt there are people out there who just don't like it. They don't see what the big deal is. You're entitled to that opinion. But I also think there's a lot of people out there who are just sick and tired of people talking about it. They're sick and tired of CM Punk. They don't like Punk. And so it colors their judgment a little bit. I don't doubt that there's some of that going on here too. I thought that it was, you know, a great promo because it left you wondering, right? What was real and what wasn't? And I still say some of the best promos are the ones that blend real-life emotions in with storyline. It's the reason why I put that Bret Hart promo on the list a few weeks ago, where he snapped. I don't doubt there was some genuine frustration, especially with Shawn and what was going on back then. And Bret had thought he was wrestling Shawn at WrestleMania and plans changed. And I'm sure there was a lot of genuine frustration there mixed in with storyline. And it made for, I mean, besides the cursing, obviously the cursing is what people remember about Bret snapping on that show, but those to me are some of the best promos. And so I'm going to play the audio for you here. This is CM Punk's pipe bomb from Raw back in June of 2011.
John Cena, while you lay there, hopefully as uncomfortable as you possibly can be, I want you to listen to me. I want you to digest this, because before I leave in 3 weeks with your WWE Championship, I have a lot of things I want to get off my chest. I don't hate you, John. I don't even dislike you. I do like you. I like you a hell of a lot more than I like most people in the back. I hate this idea that you're the best. Because you're not. I'm the best. I'm the best in the world. There's one thing you're better at than I am, and that's kissing Vince McMahon's ass. You're as good as kissing Vince's ass as Hulk Hogan was. I don't know if you're as good as Dwayne, though. He's a pretty good ass kisser. Always was and still is. Oops, I'm breaking the fourth wall. I am the best wrestler in the world. I've been the best ever since day one when I walked into this company. And I've been vilified and hated since that day because Paul Heyman saw something in me that nobody else wanted to admit. That's right, I'm a Paul Heyman guy. You know who else was a Paul Heyman guy? Brock Lesnar. And he split just like I'm splitting, but the biggest difference between me and Brock is I'm going to leave with the WWE Championship. I've grabbed so many of Vincent K. McMahon's imaginary brass rings that it's finally dawned on me that they're just that. They're completely imaginary. The only thing that's real is me. And the fact that day in and day out for almost 6 years, I have proved to everybody in the world that I am the best on this microphone, in that ring, even at commentary. Nobody can touch me. And yet, no matter how many times I prove it, I'm not on your lovely little collector cups. I'm not on the cover of the program. I'm barely promoted. I don't get to be in movies. I'm certainly not on any crappy show on the USA Network. I'm not on the poster of WrestleMania. I'm not in the signature that's produced at the start of the show. I'm not on Conan O'Brien, I'm not on Jimmy Fallon, but the fact of the matter is I should be, and trust me, this isn't sour grapes, but the fact that Dwayne is in the main event of WrestleMania next year and I'm not makes me sick. Oh, hey, let me get something straight. Those of you who are cheering me right now, you are just the biggest part of me leaving as anything else. Because you're the ones that are sipping out of those collector cups right now. You're the ones that buy those programs that my face isn't on the cover of. And then at 5 in the morning at the airport, you try to shove it in my face so you can get an autograph and try to sell it on eBay because you're too lazy to go get a real job. I'm leaving with the WWE Championship on July 17th, and hell, who knows, maybe I'll go defend it in New Japan Pro Wrestling. Maybe I'll go back to Ring of Honor. Hey, Colt Cabana, how you doing? The reason I'm leaving is you people, because after I'm gone, you're still going to pour money into this company. I'm just a spoke on the wheel. The wheel's going to keep turning, and I understand that. But Vince McMahon's going to make money despite himself. He's a millionaire who should be a billionaire. You know why he's not a billionaire? It's because he surrounds himself with glad-handing, nonsensical...
douchebag.
Yes, men. Like John Laurinaitis, who's going to tell him everything that he wants to hear. And I'd like to think that maybe this company will be better after Vince McMahon's dead. But the fact is, it's going to get taken over by his idiotic daughter and his doofus son-in-law and the rest of his stupid family. Let me tell you a personal story about Vince McMahon, all right? Do we do this whole bully camp?
So that promo got a lot of people talking. I can still remember the night that I watched it. Even though, and they deserve a lot of credit for the way they did this, because even the way they cut away, they cut his mic, they lingered for a little bit, and they just cut to black. They just went right off the air. They really did their best to make you think, wait a minute, this was real. What did I just watch here? And plant those seeds of doubt in your mind. Even with the people who think they know everything, it's like, wait a minute, what did I just see? And to me, that's the hallmark of a great promo. And not every promo has to be like that. Not even every promo in this countdown is necessarily a mix of real and fake. You could have a completely manufactured feud between two people and one guy cuts the greatest promo of all time. Not every promo has to be this way, but I thought it made this one great. And it had an immediate effect. And I think that's maybe the biggest takeaway from this is CM Punk was a star. He was a star. He held world titles before in the company. But at that point, he wasn't doing anything. He really was kind of stuck in the muck, and they weren't doing much with him. And in one night, with one speech, with one promo, this guy talked himself into the biggest run of his entire career. He talked himself into millions of dollars and pay-per-view main events that he otherwise would not have had. Here's a guy who, like I said, had one foot out the door. They were doing nothing with him. He legit thought he was leaving. One foot out the door. He went from legitimately being days away from walking out to being their biggest babyface and holding the championship for 434 days. But, you know, for as much as Punk talked about wanting to change the company, when you really look back, when you really look back at the fallout from all of this, all those things that Punk wanted to do, forget the ice cream bars, but, you know, all of these things that Punk wanted them to do, I don't want to call it a failure, but, you know, unfortunately, I don't think that the company changed quite as much as he had hoped, or else he'd probably still be working there. But maybe one of the biggest changes, and I think him and Daniel Bryan both deserve credit for this. Some of you might think they deserve blame, because this goes to the whole issue of, is WWE better off now? They have a lot of indie guys, right? They have a lot of indie guys in NXT. They have a lot of indie guys in the company on top who have backgrounds on the independent scene. Seth Rollins falls into that category. Dean Ambrose falls into that category. Kevin Owens falls into that category. Sami Zayn falls into that category. They got a bunch of guys like that down in NXT. They've got Austin Aries, and they've got Roderick Strong, and they've, right, all of these people. The Cruiserweight Classic, and they brought in guys like Drew Gulak and Zack Sabre Jr. and Noam Dar, and you know, a lot of these guys are like indie darlings. They've made their names on the independent scene. And there are a lot of people who, you know, look at the lay of the land right now in WWE and declining ratings and that sort of thing. And they say, see, this is because WWE is listening to the fans too much. And because they've just kowtowed to all of this indie talent and all of these indie guys that nobody wants to see. I don't necessarily buy that. You can make that argument, but I don't know that I necessarily agree with all of that. I think there's probably some truth in the middle there somewhere. So that's what I mean when I say you could either give Punk and Brian credit or you can give them blame. It depends on how you look at it. But those two guys deserve a lot of credit for changing WWE in this way. It opened, I think, the company's eyes up to the fact that, hey, we can take guys from like Ring of Honor and from the independents. There was a time where WWE was not really pulling guys from the independents, or they had to look a certain way. Well, if we're going to take somebody, they have to be 6'2", 230 pounds. They had like edicts like that, and their worldview, I guess you could say, and I don't know if this is a Vince McMahon thing or a Triple H thing or who deserves credit for it, but when they saw Punk get over the way he did, and Punk came from the indies, and they saw Brian get over the way he did, and probably couldn't even figure out why. Why do people love this guy so much? They had to be dragged kicking and screaming to put that guy in the WrestleMania main event, but they did the right thing. Before those guys came along, they really weren't bringing in guys like that, let alone pushing them to the top. Punk and Brian opened the floodgates. They opened the floodgates for a lot of these other guys like Kevin Owens and like Sami Zayn, who otherwise might not have ever gotten a second look from WWE. There was a period of time where I thought there was a better chance of a meteor hitting Earth and wiping us all out than WWE signing Kevin Steen to a contract. Because back then, it was almost unfathomable that they would bring in a guy like that. But their view began to change, and I think you could trace it back to Punk and Brian getting over the way that they did. And they did. Punk got over huge. For him, this was great for his career. I don't know that overall it helped, you know, people that were in the company at the time the way that he maybe had hoped it would. And I'm sure he would have loved to have seen his friend Colt Cabana get another contract and come back, and that never happened either. But Punk sure benefited from it. Like I said, he went on the biggest run of his career and made more money than he probably ever has. And so that, to me, is the ultimate fallout from this whole thing. Now, that being said, as much as Punk got over and he was a huge babyface, and the fans clearly liked him more than John Cena, fact is, he was still only number two behind John Cena. Punk may have been the champion for all those months, but he was still playing second fiddle on all of those pay-per-views to John Cena. Even the pay-per-view where John Cena headlined against John Laurinaitis, your WWE champion CM Punk was not in the main event. And that's just how it went. Until he turned heel. And the heel turn was probably the best thing for him at that point. But he was still playing second fiddle to John Cena. But, you know, I look at Punk and I say, this guy married AJ Lee, and he did get a multi-million dollar payday for a two-minute ass-kicking in UFC. And so I think he did all right for himself. Funny enough, coming into UFC and getting a pay-per-view spot in his very first fight, right? In theory, that meant that a couple of other experienced fighters got bumped off a show that they otherwise would have been on, which is the same thing he resented about The Rock coming in and getting the main event of WrestleMania 28. And part of it was probably just selfish. He wanted to be in the main event, and he felt Rock was taking his spot. But if you really look at it, he kind of did the same thing that he was criticizing The Rock for, right? But Vince did that match at WrestleMania 28 because it was the biggest money match that he could possibly do. Up to that point, that became the biggest money match in WrestleMania history, was Rock versus Cena. And, you know, just like Dana White was smart enough to realize that CM Punk, who had no prior fight experience and was 36 years old, CM Punk coming in and fighting on pay-per-view would also make them a shit ton of money. He's not a stupid guy. So at the end of the day, the lesson here is that it's all about the money. It's all about the money because it's a business. And Punk knows that full well. Because just like Brock Lesnar, CM Punk left, and now he is a much bigger star than he ever was before. So we'll continue our countdown next week. We're going to be doing number two. Now, if you look at the next few weeks, the whole point of the top nine is that it will culminate with the number one greatest interview of all time on the November 6th episode of The Sound Off. That's our 9-year anniversary show. That's how I wanted to time it. Well, next week is going to be the number two promo, and then there's another week. And so my plan is, for that week in between number two and number one, I've got a bunch of promos I want to give some time to here. I don't know if I'll play them, but I want to talk about them and give them some airtime on my my list of honorable mentions. All the promos that I would have loved to have ranked in this list, but I just couldn't find a spot for them. So the plan is to do number two next week. Then we'll essentially skip a week between two and one, but that week we'll talk about some honorable mentions, and then number one will come on the November 6th episode. So I'll keep you guys guessing for a little bit. But yeah, two more promos left in this countdown. Good luck guessing. If you have questions for the mailbag, you could email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything you guys send me. I'm just absurdly backed up. So if I ignore you or I don't include your question on the show, please do not be offended. And it may pop up on the show at some point. Every now and then I'll pluck a question from the mailbag that I got 6 weeks ago and I'll put it on the show. It's completely random. It's just as I go through them, anything that either is timely or anything that I just happen to think is a great question, I'll pull it and use it on the show. So if I can't respond to you, though, please be aware I do read everything you guys send me. I appreciate it. Follow me on Twitter, @Solemonster. You can vote in our poll every single Monday. Thumbs up, thumbs down from Monday Night Raw. You can make a PayPal donation at any time on thesolemonster.com and get yourself a shout-out here on this show. You can use our Audible link. Remember, don't buy any Nancy Grace books. Even though you're not buying, you get your free book with our link. Don't even use the free link. Don't waste your free link on your free book on Nancy Grace. You can get The Death of WCW, any number of wrestling books. Buy the fucking Cat in the Hat, anything but Nancy Grace. Audibletrial.com/Solemonster is the link to use there. And again, I want to say thank you to Matt Harrigan and give a plug for superkickfoundation.org if you want to support his efforts on there to clothe the homeless with wrestling merch. Matt's a good guy, and I want to thank him publicly again for the winged eagle replica that I'm staring at right now. One of the nicest things anybody's ever done for me, and I just have the best fans in the world. So, we will be back next weekend with a brand new podcast. That'll be episode 466. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and we will see you right back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster Sounds Off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Solemonster Sounds Off. Since 2007, the Solemonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster Sound Off.